I'm Bill Castle, and this is Free Expression. This program is all about conveying the Christian message from a Catholic point of view and defending the liberty which makes it possible to do that. We talk with creative, interesting people examining human sexuality, as well as notorious efforts to conceal the medical harm being done to gender-conflicted young people. Join us, sit back, and enjoy some free expression. Just about everything we thought we understood about gender and the functions of sexuality seems to have been turned on its head. It's claimed that there are multiple genders besides male and female. So-called same-sex marriage has made common certain relationships that were once considered profoundly immoral. In vitro fertilization and surrogate parenting have brought us whole new ways of propagating the human species. Dr. John Finley and several of his colleagues have taken on the challenge of trying to make sense of this brave new sexual world with a book titled Sexual Identity: The Harmony of Philosophy, Science, and Revelation. Dr. Finley, guide us through this dense forest. What do we know about sex today?
Bill, thank you very much. It's great to be speaking with you. The whole point of gathering these co-authors together with myself was to be able to take advantage of precisely the marvelous work that's been done in many of the scientific and medical fields, which give us greater insight than ever before into the profound biological realities that are at play in our human organisms as male and female. What we have is a reconfirmation in greater detail than ever before of what humans have more or less known all along, which is that part of being human means to be either male or female. Now, of course, we've also known all along that occasionally, as with any biological reality, there can be deficiencies, there can be various forms of a kind of disability, and this includes in the reproductive or sexual realm. And so these disorders of sexual development, which occur quite rarely, are precisely that. They're a kind of disorder within a particular developmental process. And so these don't invalidate the fundamental insight that there are two and only two sexes, male and female. Simultaneously with the discoveries in modern science, which are all legitimate, we have this growing subjectivism whereby there's a voice out there that encourages people to hold to the idea that what we are first and foremost are our feelings. And so this is part of what has led to the transgender movement, the idea that because we experience or perceive ourselves to be this or that, therefore we are this or that, right? In this case, because I perceive myself, perhaps even though biologically male, to be a female for whatever reason, therefore I ought to be considered a female. Now, it's important, of course, to make a distinction between any given person who's suffering in this way, who experiences these feelings, who is, for one reason or another, confused about their sexual identity. We have to distinguish between the person and the movement or the ideology, the ideas that are being espoused to the effect that society as a whole ought to embrace a falsehood, namely that there exist multiple genders.
It's one thing to say that someone might wish to be the opposite sex. There are all kinds of reasons why they might. Maybe they had traumatic experiences. Maybe they had terrible relationships with their parents. There are any number of reasons. But to then make the leap from that to believe that you are the opposite sex or that you are some undefined gender seems to me to step into the realm of the irrational. How serious do you think this is?
Well, you know, I would even back up one step and make perhaps an even earlier distinction, which is that it's one thing to experience an uncomfortability with one's sexuality.
Right.
And I think, as you say, there are all sorts of personal, experiential reasons why this can happen. But simply experiencing a discomfort with one's own sex does not mean that, therefore, you feel like you must be the other sex. And I think that distinction has been confused, so that even a lot of well-meaning providers and caregivers might approach a young person, say a boy, a young man who's experiencing a difficulty with his own sexuality, and they therefore assume, oh, well, this must mean that you feel like you're a girl, or this must mean that you really want to be a girl, and therefore we should in some way support your desires. So that having been said, when it comes to the life of any individual person, this is a very serious issue, because our sexuality, of course, is not something superficial in us, like our hair color, our eye color. It's something that pervades our organism much more deeply, and in fact is manifested at the chromosomal level in every cell in our body and involves whole organ systems, and none of our other individual capacities are like that. It's also, at the same time, the only biological reality in us that's explicitly interpersonal. When it comes to the realm of sexuality, even biologically, it involves relations with another person, either a person of the opposite sex or the future person who is a child. And so I think it's those two aspects of our sexuality is what makes this such a complex and serious issue, namely that it's deeply biologically engraved in our organism, but it's also interpersonal, and therefore this realm of relationality. And of course, personal relationships can have all sorts of difficulties. And that's where I think a lot of this, as you point out, does come from, is that we are in a culture which has more or less embraced the corruption of the most important interpersonal relationships. No-fault divorce, for example, between husband and wife. Abortion, the separation of sexuality from reproduction, with the widespread use of contraception, the proliferation of pornography, all of these things have the effect of dissolving the most important human relationships, in virtue of which man and woman are important to begin with. And so, therefore, I don't think it should be surprising that the very notions then of what it is to be man and woman and their significance should start to fade from view in our culture. It's extremely important for people to know the truth, but also to, with any given person struggling with this issue, to maintain the relationship as much as possible, a relationship of love, but that's also grounded in truth, so that we don't lose sight of the ultimate goal, that we want the good for any given person. And that in this case, this good means for the person as much as possible to accept who he or she is as a child of God and is created by God in the biology intended for the person's own ultimate happiness. Of course, this also involves a reminder that our culture is also very much allergic to, which is that difficulty and suffering are a part of the human condition, but in the Christian view of things, can be taken up for the good. And I think that's another hugely important aspect of these sorts of cultural battles that we need to somehow reawaken our consciousness of in our society.
It's one thing to look at this on the personal level and grant that people have sincere conflicts and genuine emotional issues to deal with, but there seems to be other agendas at work here. Why has this so taken over the medical establishment? Why has it become such an imperative that people be reinforced in their perception that they're in the wrong sex?
That's a very, very important point. It's a good question. I think a lot of what this shows, when it comes to the medicine and the biology, the facts are the facts. It is still, absolutely speaking, the case that by all scientific standards, there are only two sexes. So the question that you raise is a good one. Why is it that in medical and scientific quarters, there's been a kind of kowtowing to this social movement, this ideology? And I think part of what it shows is that human beings cannot live by science, whether for good or ill, whether it's you know, kind of good, accurate science or badly done science, it's not something we can live by. Science is a derivative form of human expertise with a very technical language all its own. Human beings have to live by something more fundamental, something broader and deeper than mere science. And what we've had in our culture for quite some time has been a marvelously developed science, but without that deeper, broader foundation in a right philosophy and a right theology that could shepherd and guide scientific endeavor, such that when you have a powerful movement come along like subjectivism, which endorses the view that a person should fundamentally do as they like or be whatever they wish to be, even the best science is not going to be able to hold up on its own against that kind of a movement. I'll give you an example. The St. Louis newspaper last year ran a headline speaking about how a particular young trans woman was being denied her right to exist. Now, if you really take that language seriously, if you think that what's at stake is a trans person's right to exist, well, even the best science is not going to be able to stand up to that. So rhetorically, this subjectivism has become extremely powerful in the consciousness of our society. It's very important to have good science and to be able to rely on it, but we also have to realize that science by itself is not going to be able to be the answer here.
Well, you've certainly taken a holistic approach here. You're dealing with philosophy, you're dealing with science, you're dealing with theology and revelation. Can people have that kind of a broad perspective? Can you get people to look beyond their immediate emotional suffering or their political inclinations and step back and take a big picture perspective like that?
Well, I think you can. You know, I think it's certainly a big endeavor, but in any given case, we have to avail ourselves of all the resources that we possess. While it's true that there are these great errors in our society and huge confusions, it's also the case that in many ways, we've never had the resources that we do now, you know, when it comes to the development of science and medicine. But even, say, from a Catholic Christian perspective, 2,000 years worth of extraordinarily rich theological tradition and spiritual tradition, right? It's really incumbent on us to bring all these resources to bear. It takes people from different disciplines, different fields, getting together and working together in order to address these multifaceted cultural problems. In the academic world, the intellectual world, we're used to compartmentalization, where you have different fields and different departments, even within the same university, barely knowing what goes on in each other's hallways. And that's the sort of thing that really has to change in one way or another if we're going to make headway along these lines.
Well, speaking of the academic world, it's difficult for anybody who doesn't sign off on the current view to even be heard. We hear about people losing jobs and being curtailed in their ability to speak publicly. What advice would you offer anybody who wishes to speak up for some kind of common sense in this area?
My own experience within those exact types of conditions is fairly limited, but I've certainly worked with people who are in just the sorts of position you're talking about. And I would say the advice I would give is that there are other people out there who are in similar circumstances, who've maybe been in your shoes and with whom it would be very worth to get in contact with. It doesn't take a whole lot of looking around on the internet and various publications to be able to find at least a handful of people in your field or a very closely related field who are in the same kind of situation. And I think it's really important for these people to network and to be able to support each other, communicate with each other, and when possible, get together in order to discuss next steps and ways forward in terms of advancing the legitimacy of their own field, but within a sane context. A real problem, it points to the fact that when it comes to the issues today in our society, they're as much a crisis of human reason as they are of, say, human sexuality. We're seeing hand in hand a failure to live according to the truth of what it means to be human as male and female, but also a failure to even perceive the most basic truths. Even voices from the secular realm have acknowledged this. For example, there was that powerful documentary that came out a couple of years ago called The Social Dilemma. And at the heart of the issue in that documentary is the fact that people are losing the ability to even perceive or know what is true on the most basic level, because of the influence of social media and the internet and the ways in which these forms of media are tailored to be able to capture our attention and sway our opinions and our very awareness of things based on the images and the sound bites that they're able to present to us.
Well, let's hope that this book can spur some of those conversations that need to be held. It's Sexual Identity, The Harmony of Philosophy, Science, and Revelation. Dr. John DeSilva Finley is the editor, and it's from Emmaus Road Publishing. I assume it's in general distribution and can be obtained through all the usual channels?
That's exactly right. It's on Amazon. It's one click away, as they say.
John Finley, thank you very much for talking with us.
It's wonderful to be on, Bill. I wish you all the best. Thank you.
It It's no secret that the mainstream media have become highly ideological. These days, we just assume that any news we get from the major networks, publications, or online journals is going to have a definite point of view with some key facts ignored or glossed over. Perhaps more disappointing, though, is the sad reality that civil liberties groups, organizations like the ACLU, which claim to defend the free flow of information, seem to have joined in the cover-ups. Sarah Weaver, who writes for the Daily Caller, recently did a piece examining efforts to ignore the physical and emotional damage being done to children who become convinced that they're the opposite sex. And this has included ignoring threats to doctors, scientists, and activists trying to expose these horrific practices. Strangely, some of these threats have been instigated by the professional medical associations themselves. Sarah, the situation is complex and a little confusing. Lay it out for us, would you please?
Yes, absolutely, and thanks for having me on, Bill. A couple of these medical organizations sent out a letter to the DOJ last month, essentially asking the DOJ to use its power to track and potentially prosecute journalists and activists who uncover transgender treatment that mostly children's hospitals have been providing to young gender-confused teenagers and even younger. We have the American Academy of Pediatrics, the American Medical Association, and the Children's Hospital Association all saying that they are collectively representing more than 270,000 physicians and essentially asked the DOJ to use their power against individuals such as Chris Rufo, Lizzie TikTok, others that uncover medical treatments such as transgender surgeries, puberty blockers, hormone therapies. And this, you know, is definitely a gross misuse of their power. And I thought, you know, these free speech organizations that were very vocal against Donald Trump for his many criticisms of the media, and whatever you think of those criticisms, a lot of these organizations like the ACLU and others that are perhaps a little less well-known, but they were very vocal about Trump. And some of them, you know, even showed some level of bipartisanship in their criticism of, for instance, the Obama DOJ going after Fox News' James Rosen. But none of them really responded to several requests for comment from the Daily Caller, us basically wondering, are these free speech organizations going to be consistent in the face of this very obvious ploy by the DOJ and by the medical organizations to use the DOJ against journalists they don't like?
Yeah, this really raises a lot of very strange questions. I mean, the first question, I guess, comes to mind is why would the professional associations want to take this kind of a stance? And the second would be, why are we seeing this inconsistency among the free speech groups?
I think the transgender issue, it's very, very tricky and delicate. And while, you know, it's my personal opinion that the right and wrong of the situation is self-evident, a lot of people, they don't want to be seen as being transphobic. They don't want to be seen as being hateful against children that are struggling with gender dysphoria. So they pretty much just stay out of the entire debate. But their silence is really, you know, I don't want to say they're complicit because I don't think, you know, silence necessarily equals violence. But their silence is definitely hurting people that they could help if they were more vocal and basically saying, yes, people who uncover, for instance, children's hospitals, like you have Matt Walsh uncovering Vanderbilt University for touting how much money you can make off of chemically castrating young boys and girls.
Right.
You know, they want you to go after people like Matt Walsh. And I think these free speech organizations have an opportunity and a missed opportunity to basically prove to the world that they are extremely nonpartisan, that they are free speech organizations first and foremost, and that no matter what the political party of the people curbing free speech, they will do the right thing and criticize them.
I can't claim to do a thorough search of the media every day, but yours was the first article that I have seen that actually highlights this. There seems to have been a cover-up, or at the very least a glossing over, that goes all the way through the media as well. So this you sort of have a three-pronged effort to block this whole story.
Yeah, no, it is a tragic course of events. Media really hasn't been covering this like they should. Again, these are fellow journalists. You know, I know Chris Rufo, Matt Walsh, people like that, even some reporting Daily Caller has done, they are considered to be kind of polarizing figures. That said, they are journalists, and they are uncovering the truth. And if you are a journalist, even if you work for a liberal media outlet, you work for CNN or NBC, you should care whenever the DOJ says journalists should be penalized by the Department of Justice, by the government itself, for uncovering certain things. And yes, you really would have expected, just like you would have expected from the free speech organizations, that they would have jumped to the defense of people who are having their speech curve, you would expect from fellow journalists that they would report on other journalists basically being encouraged to be censored. But we really didn't see that. I mean, obviously there are exceptions, and a lot of organizations have done the right thing and reported on this. But I know at the Daily Caller, we definitely saw a missed opportunity here about kind of reporting this out and looking into, like, who's responsible here, and who could have done more, and what could they have done? And I think looking into the free speech organizations themselves was certainly very enlightening to do, because they basically have been entirely silent.
Since you've been following this issue, what do you expect is going to happen? Will the Department of Justice actually become involved in active prosecutions of critics? What lies ahead?
I can't, you know, make an exact strategic, saying what the DOJ is gonna do, but it has had a history of politicizing issues and going after conservatives and Christians and Catholics in a very politicized manner. And, you know, I wish I could say otherwise, but, you know, you have the case of the pro-life activist, I think it was Philadelphia, who was raided by the FBI after being cleared of charges by local law enforcement. The DOJ went after him, and it's really hard not to, and I know his lawyer is saying things to this effect, it's really hard not to say that basically this is a case that's being made of by the DOJ saying, you know, this is what we'll do to you if you're pro-life, this is what we'll do to you if you're Catholic, and if you're upfront about those beliefs you have. You know, you can have those beliefs, but you need to, like, be quiet about them. But I know that a lot of people are seeing this as, you know, a plan by the FBI and by the DOJ to become politicized and to prosecute people who are of the political party they don't prefer. And you have, obviously, a very notorious instance of Merrick Garland calling concerned parents at student board meetings terrorists because they're speaking out, exercising their First Amendment rights. You have a DOJ that is showing a lot of the hallmarks of a totalitarian government, targeting individuals and organizations that are speaking out against the government. You know, we have a First Amendment for a reason, but the DOJ seems to have forgotten that.
Now, since this is Catholic radio, the question that naturally comes to my mind is, can this even reach into the churches? Could we find that priests who preach on these sensitive issues, would they be the subject of targeting? And who will come to their aid?
No, maybe so. I mean, I think everyone does very well to be extremely vigilant at this time. You know, in terms of Catholics being targeted, again, I'd point to this instance of the pro-life father of, I think he has like 7 children or something. And, you know, you have some Republicans sort of taking action against it. I think Josh Hawley sent a letter to the Biden's administration's DOJ saying that what the DOJ did was totally beyond the pale. But, you know, obviously a letter only does so much. Hopefully the backlash against these kind of instances will keep Catholics and other religious denominations from being improperly targeted. But, you know, we'll just have to see and be extra vigilant in the meantime.
Well, I imagine you guys will be keeping a pretty close eye on this situation, so I may be checking back with you to see about what else develops. Thanks very much for taking a couple minutes and letting us know what's going on this front. This is an extremely dangerous and threatening situation. It really speaks to the heart of our rights as Americans.
Of course. Happy to chat.
A lovely and appropriate song from Wisconsin-based Catholic singer-songwriter Anna Nuzzo. The piece is titled Falling on My Knees, and it comes from her 2014 album, Be Love. Check out her website, annanuzzo.com. That's annanuzzo.com. Be with us next time when we explore other aspects of religious communication and look deeper into the great Christian heritage of free expression. Free Expression with Bill Castle is a production of Good Shepherd Catholic Radio and Company Publications, where good books, good music, and good radio are always good company. Dan Kuras provided technical assistance. Theme and incidental music are by Dan Adam. The program was produced and directed by Bill Castle. This is Good Shepherd Catholic Radio.